The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. As November draws to a close, we end the month with a humdinger of a show as we welcome back the ever-popular Lyle Blackburn to discuss his fantastic new book, Boggy Creek Casebook. Stories of the folk monster go back over a century, and Lyle has collated a historical timeline of reports using newspaper archives, original reports, and first-hand witness interviews. With over 90 encounters recorded, Lyle's book shows there is far more to the Boggy Creek monster than just those shown in Charles B. Pierce's cult classic film, The Legend of Boggy Creek. Lyle and I discuss his continuing relationship with both the town of Folk and its infamous cryptid, some of the most notable cases he covers in the book, and much more besides. As always, it was great to speak with Lyle, and I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation. As always, you can get the show early and a bonus episode every month by signing up for our Patreon. You can find the link in the show notes, and it's just $4 a month. You can also find us across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, the artwork is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Okay, let's take a return trip to the Sulphur River Bottoms as we join Lyle on the hunt for the Beast of Boggy Creek. This week, it's a warm welcome back to one of my listeners' favourite guests, and also one of mine, Lyle Blackburn, with his second book of the year, Boggy Creek Casebook, available now, a new album with his band Ghoultown, as well as narration duties on the Mothman Legacy. 2020 has not slowed this gentleman down. Lyle, welcome. How are we?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
My goodness, as we were talking before we dove into the interview, it's been one hell of a year for you so far.
Yeah, it's been, I think it's been the busiest year yet, which is ironic considering at first I thought with the shutdowns and so forth and canceling of events, I thought, well, this is going to be a slow year, but it's turned out to be the opposite. So, you know, I can't complain considering the horrors of 2020. So, yeah, it's been a ride.
Absolutely. I must admit, I was quite surprised when I saw that there was a new book coming, because obviously we spoke a few months ago in regards to the Marvelous Sinister Swamps book. So when I saw that Boggy Creek Casebook was coming down the line, I thought, wow, fantastic.
Yeah, well, it was something I kind of put together between when Sinister Swamps was complete, and I believe that was, I think I had completed that, and then there was a shutdown which affected the schedule for recording our new album with my band Ghoultown. So there was a delay there because the studio itself and the practice rehearsal studios and things had kind of shut down, and we were a little uncertain with the whole coronavirus COVID thing. And so I had thought, well, you know, I can, what can I work on, you know, in between, because the album was written and I'm just waiting. So,
yeah.
You know, the casebook was something that I've been wanting to do. So I just kind of started working on it, and then it just, you know, I don't know how I finished it, but yeah, I just sort of did that in the middle of other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's one of those things that I think's long overdue. Not that that's a criticism, Lyle. because I think when we've got such a specific cryptid as we have with the folk monster, I think it's really important that we get a real sense of just how frequently this creature has been allegedly seen over the last century, because a lot of people's knowledge is simply based on Charles B. Pierce's film from the early 1970s. But with your casebook, you've been able to go back sort of to the beginning of the 20th century, which is where these reports started to circulate.
Yeah, certainly. It's something that's kind of come up over the years. I mean, my book, The Beast of Boggy Creek, came out in 2012, and then I cover some more sightings in Beyond Boggy Creek, which came out in three some odd years later. But I still frequently see people posting online, like saying things like, "Are there still sightings?" Mm. Now, if they've read my first two books, of course, would be familiar with more modern sightings. But, you know, your average person who may just be a fan of the movie, and the movie certainly has had some new life because The Legend of Boggy Creek was recently remastered and restored and re-released on Blu-ray. So I saw a lot of questions continuing about, is there been any sightings? So I thought, you know, it would be great to just collect the sightings themselves one after another, you know, pulled from all my sources, whether they were mentioned in Beast of Boggy Creek or Beyond Boggy Creek, or whether I'd mentioned in other magazine articles, or if there were things that I had documented that I had never written about or released. So that's kind of how the idea for the book came up, and I thought it's sort of a supplement. If you just want to read the sightings only, no story or grand narrative, just, you know, sighting, that's kind of how I did it. So in some regard, I was able to pull things from others, and I mean, I reworked it for the book, but, you know, I wasn't starting from zero per se.
Yeah, I think it is it's an excellent companion to the other two books, because, as you say, I'm not surprised, but it is interesting just how much appetite there still is for the Boggy Creek monster, because often these creatures will sometimes disappear back into the realms of the mysterious after a spate of sightings. But Boggy Creek, because I think it's so ingrained in a generation, Lyle, a lot of people grew up with this creature, and a lot of people seem to have a real soft spot for it, which clearly they haven't met it, going on some of the encounters, because I think that would tend to change their opinion about this creature. But there seems to be a real appetite and love for this creature for some reason.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it ingrained itself in the psyche of anybody who was interested in strange creatures, and certainly Bigfoot. And, you know, the love and the experience people had it because of the movie, you know, they've passed it on to their kids. And then, of course, some of the TV shows, Finding Bigfoot and so forth, you know, those guys were influenced by the movie and have gone back and revisited the area. And so it just perpetually kind of keeps going. Whereas, like you say, some of these, you know, just like, you know, my book, Momo, the Missouri Monster, it was sort of more concentrated in a period of time in the 70s. And there really hasn't been much in that specific area since. Unlike, you know, the Boggy Creek case near Falk, there has literally been a steady stream of credible sightings. So it's been one of those that you kind of went under the radar because, you know, a huge, widely circulated movie, of course, people are going to, you know, it exposes more people to the case. And since then, it's been kind of up to me to say, hey, yeah, there is more sightings. And, you know, there's, while there's not like another, I mean, there's sort of another movie, we made a documentary, but as far as just something that's, you know, carries on to the very present, that's been my book. So I felt, you know, as the Boggy Creek historian, that it was important to kind of keep feeding people's desire to know more about it.
Yeah. And I think it is interesting, as you say that, because people would class you as the Boggy Creek's biographer, really, now, Lyle. I think you've become synonymous with this particular cryptid. And it's also clear that the people of Falk have really taken a shine to you, because obviously the case book, there is a lot of personal interviews that you've undertaken and organised yourself, as well as people coming forwards and saying that they knew of relatives that had perhaps seen something. And I think when we spoke previously, I think it was very interesting that I think when you first went there, you were saying people were a little bit reticent and weren't really sure what you were all about and weren't sure how you were going to treat the situation and their experiences. And I think through the quality of your work and your honesty and your integrity and how you've treated these people, Lyle, they've clearly taken you under their wing. And I would, you know, imagine that you're highly thought of in the area because people still come forwards to you.
Yeah, that's been beneficial, is to, you know, have the trust of the community there, because in some ways it is their story and their heritage and things that have passed down from family to family. So they've kind of taken me in many cases and included me in sharing those personal stories. And that, you know, of course, over the years, having released the books, and they can see very well that, you know, I've treated the subject respectfully and just attempted to document it in a serious manner and, you know, not be judgmental. It's just simply, this is what people report and this is what has happened and here it is. And so that's, you know, been kind of my goal anyways, is to just, you know, have some integrity with the subject. So that's gone a long way as the years have progressed, where at first I didn't realize I was going to become well known for the Boggy Creek case. I was just another guy who thought it was cool.
Yeah.
But it certainly paid off by doing it the right way. And the case book is a great example, because you can just see how many stories there are in there that I've collected, you know, even in recent years.
Yeah, I think, is there over 90 reports and sighting statements inside the book?
Yeah, there's something over, yeah, around almost 100, I think. And that's, you know, and it had to have some with details. I mean, there were some with vague things, but, you know, I included all those that I thought were credible and all those that had some amount of meat to the story. You know, so that it had some details to each one.
Yeah, and it is interesting, I think, when you look at the historical aspects of this, because there have been numerous books written about other wild men and wild creatures across America at the turn of the 19th century and coming into the 20th. And obviously the Falk monster seems to just sort of trickle along for a couple of decades until it gets to about the 1950s, and then it really kicks off. But it, also, interestingly, these stories predate the big Bigfoot explosion at the end of the 50s, Lyle, which a lot of people often mistakenly claim that's when Bigfoot appeared, because I've seen numerous books by several authors which clearly proves that these reports were being printed and mentioned for decades prior to this date. Is it one of those things that you think gives it a bit more credence, because some of these reports that predate this explosion lack that kind of hysterical narrative that you can see in some of these newspaper reports, and they seem rather balanced as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it you know, gives some credibility to it if there's older reports. It isn't just something that popped up, you know, in modern times overnight, which kind of can be a bit suspicious in some of these cases. But basically, you know, the Bigfoot, I mean, Bigfoot as an icon, you know, sort of in most people's mind is sort of the first, you know, on record in the West Coast stuff. But yeah, if you look back in old newspapers, and I, of course, talk about this quite a bit in Beyond Boggy Creek, where I explore the deep South in history of sightings of these type creatures, you know, they just simply weren't identified as Bigfoot per se, but there's numerous accounts that at least suggest that some sort of a Bigfoot like creature was roaming the southern part of the U.S. you know, all along, and dates back as far as you can date back, you know, the iconic West Coast Bigfoot stories.
Yeah. I think the other interesting aspect of that is that, obviously, when you read Beyond Boggy Creek, what strikes me, and this happens in several cryptid encounters, there always seems to be somebody pops up claiming that it was them, or it was their uncle, or it was their friend. I'm trying to think of the particular cryptid. Is it the Fort Worth monster that allegedly threw the tire in the air?
Yes, the Lake Worth monster.
Lake Worth monster, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And yet, one of the things I've always found interesting about the folk monster is nobody's ever said, oh yeah, it was such and such messing about. Now, do you think that's down to the fact that the town itself is quite small? Because I think the population's just under 900, so it's not the biggest town in the area. And often when we get these flaps in different areas, there's always somebody claiming responsibility with some elaborate setup and amazing ability to create special effects, which I always find baffling as well. So that is something else, I think, that gives these reports a lot more credence, because these are very serious people, Lyle. They're not prone for flights of fancy or pulling people's legs.
Yeah, I mean, there is more credibility, I think, to the sightings in that area. I mean, you know, there have been people who offhand will say, well, you know, that was, you know, somebody was responsible for that, or rarely is it a name. It's just sort of they might cite one incident or the more famous Ford encounter in 1971, or, you know, occasionally somebody will say, you know, it was moonshiners dressed up in costumes. Very, very vague sort of explanations to this, but it holds no water because there's just too many sightings. And even if it was somebody's cousin, they absolutely could not have pulled off something of this magnitude. So, but yeah, in general, there's some of these lead back to, like in the Lake Worth monster, there's two people who claim they were the Lake Worth monster. So, you know, I'm sort of like, well, which one? who is it? But at least there's somebody that can be identified with that. But in the case of the Falk monster, other than some finger pointing here and there, there's really no one that, you know, has been cited as being responsible for it in any way.
Yeah. I think it is interesting as well that you refer to moonshiners dressing up, because it seems that some people are very dismissive of Bigfoot encounters, claiming that they're marijuana growers now. So it seems that we've moved from moonshine to marijuana, Lyle. in some people's minds as an explanation. But that, once again, it's such an amount of witnesses, and especially when it comes to what's been going on around folk, quite a lot of people have taken a shot at it. So if you are going to be hoaxing, you're taking a real risk doing anything like this, because there's a lot of reports, especially in the casebook, where, you know, people claim to have even hit it.
Right. Yeah, that's something that is a big red flag, is because some of these sightings have been hunters in tree stands or sightings in remote places. It's not like somebody up on the main road running across or something. They're literally down in the bottoms, creeping around where hunters are, which just no one in their right mind who actually lives there would attempt that. Even if they could come up with some sort of a costume, which would have been extremely hard. It was hard enough to get a costume back when they were doing the movie, and they were making a movie. But somebody just on the average getting a costume, and then to put that on and to creep around down in Mercer Bayou or the Sulphur River bottoms or along Boggy Creek, is just crazy. Nobody would do that, and you certainly would take a chance of getting shot. And like you say, there's several of those incidents where people were shooting at it, and, you know, could have hit it. You know, I mean, you have to, these are allegedly big creatures, so you would have to hit it with some good firepower to bring it down. So it could have, you know, taken some hits, but if that was a person in a costume, you know, one shot and, you know, they would be stumbling and probably falling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's frustrating as well, because I have seen a very notable skeptic who's just basically said everybody's mistakenly seen a bear. And I think, well, that's one of those explanations that just seems to be based on absolutely no evidence of the reports at all. Because the thing that strikes me about the Beast of Boggy Creek is the fact that it's often described as quite slim and scrawny, Lyle, whereas anybody who's pretending or misidentifying, for example, a bear, they're not usually described as scrawny looking or emaciated, whereas often a lot of people, when they describe the creature, will say that it's scrawny but muscular, it's quite shaggy looking, and yet we're expected to believe that every single person that's seen this creature, once again, we're talking about experienced outdoors people, hunters, people who know their area, know what creatures are out there, what's supposed to be out there, that all of them have mistakenly seen a bear. And once again, you think, well, you've just not read the reports, because once again, you have numerous reports of it being seen carrying hogs and things.
Yeah, the bear explanation just doesn't suffice. There is no way, even if the creature doesn't even exist, what people are seeing is not bears every time. It's just, that's nonsense. And I see that explanation given. And while maybe there is one or two of those where somebody saw a bear, it cannot, you know, explain all of those sightings. And certainly there's been some that are just too up close, and I've got credible witnesses that attest that it was not a bear. They saw it in daylight. You know, they can't say exactly what it is, but it wasn't a human or a bear. And the bears do travel through there. There's not a bear population per se that lives in the Falk area. Bears do live in in southern Arkansas, East Texas, and on into Louisiana and stuff. There's not a very big population, and they're usually quite small. And when they're seen, it's pretty easy to identify as a bear, unless you just see a glimpse of it or something. But yeah, I don't find the bear thing to hold water.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I must admit, I've yet to see a bear that can run alongside a car.
Right. They just they need, skeptics are going to have to work harder, because that just doesn't universally explain any case. Bigfoot, you know, or Boggy Creek.
Yeah.
Either one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the prime example of that is the Carl Finch case, who's the musician who'd been performing at a Battle of the Bands, I believe, in 1967. And they were driving along, and I mean, this is the interesting thing. It's interesting how people's minds work, Lyle, when they see something like this, because I think he described they thought it was a man running in a fur coat at first. And then obviously the realization is, well, why on earth would somebody be going for a run in a fur coat?
Right. You know, and I mean, I think if you see something like this, especially in 67, your mind is going to try to find, put some sort of an identification on what you're seeing, because it's not, you don't immediately identify it as an animal. And if it's running upright, you know, Carl, and his first thought was it's a man. But that, you know, that just gets weirder and weirder when you consider it's spring in the middle of the night in this remote part of Highway 71 by the Sulphur River. Why would somebody be jogging, much less wearing a fur coat, etc.? So that, you know, the closer they got to the subject, they realized this isn't a man, you know, and he hadn't really heard of Bigfoot or anything at the time. And he certainly, this predated the Legend of Boggy Creek movie. So he just chalked it up as, I just saw something really weird and I don't know what it is. It was only years later that he saw the Legend of Boggy Creek and goes, oh man, that must have been what I saw, because I saw something that night while driving. And so those to me are credible encounters, because he didn't have a preconceived idea of what he might see if he drove through Falk. And you know, this also corresponded to a rash of sightings that had gone on in the mid 1960s down there, which were known among some of the locals that lived in the area of Jonesville, a small community by Falk. But he would have had absolutely no way of knowing about those sightings. So it's sort of corroborates what the locals were seeing from a third party.
And it is interesting as well that there does seem to be quite a few sightings around the Highway 71 Interstate 49 area, because when you look at the area, that clearly cuts a straight path south through two areas that are really quite wooded, extensive areas, Lyle. So that's what I found that quite interesting in regards to that, because clearly, if we are talking about an established creature, this has still managed to deal with this situation in regards to traffic. And I would imagine it's not the busiest road in the state either, because there's not much to it. Because I know, does it run from Texarkana down into Louisiana?
Yes.
So it is interesting. And usually it's people driving at sort of, you know, late evening or the early hours of the morning that seem to glimpse this creature as it's either running alongside or running across it, Lyle.
Yeah, because, you know, Highway 71, because it cuts a big path through a lot of area that's just wooded, very rural there, and also runs in proximity to Boggy Creek, the Sulphur River, and on down towards the Red River. So it's a good area. And since the highway corridor, you know, chops out a big chunk of it, anything that has to move, you know, from one point to another and has to cross that roadway has the potential for being seen. And of course it's more exposed. I mean, it's much harder to see the thing down in the woods because there's just so many trees and thick brush and shadows that it would be harder to see. But if it gets out on that road and is moving around at night, that's been the subject source of a lot of sightings, which to me makes sense. You know, animals need, especially large animals, they need to roam around, go where the food is, move great distances. And, you know, in order to cross that Highway 71 over the years, it would undoubtedly result in encounters as it has.
And I think one of the other aspects, there are quite a lot of witnesses who will often state that they didn't believe in Bigfoot, or they just thought it was nonsense, until they essentially get their minds changed for them, whether they want to or not. Lyle, did you often find these people were scared of what they'd seen, or they were still having trouble trying to comprehend what on earth they'd witnessed?
It's kind of a split. I mean, some of them were traumatized and frightened by what they had seen, and some, you know, weren't as much scared by just as they were, you know, perplexed or amazed that they had seen something. And I think it also depends on the context of how you see it. You know, if you're in a position of being vulnerable, you're walking or canoeing through the swamp and you see it, you know, you're in its domain, it's going to be scary. If it darts across the road, you're in a car, maybe not as scary, or what have you. So it just depends on the sighting. And certainly, you know, the people who didn't believe in Bigfoot per se, or the Falk monster, I find to be, you know, credible. And I like those because, again, they're not out there looking for Bigfoot. It's like Bigfoot found them, so to speak. And you know, it's almost like if the sighting is convincing enough to turn a skeptical person into someone who concedes that there is something out there, then that to me is more significant than somebody who's like, well, I'm going looking for Bigfoot and by darned, I saw one, you know. You know, because you're preconceived to look for it. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, not to say that those things don't happen, but just that I like it when there's, you know, somebody, I didn't believe in this whatsoever, thought it was nonsense until I saw what I saw, you know.
Well, yeah, this is the thing about the Falk monster, is it likes to sort of really surprise people, because I think, I don't think there is a case where somebody was actively looking for it, Lyle. They're all sort of just going about their normal stuff, whether they're out canoeing or driving about or going for a walk, or they're at home and something decides to have a walk past or help itself to some chickens or whatever. It lacks that kind of attitude where people are actively looking for this. When we look at other cases, people, you know, might be aware of the certain things, or they, whatever they're looking for is out there. This creature seems to really enjoy sneaking up on people.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe one case in the book where it was a person researching. No, there's two where people are in the area for the purpose of researching Bigfoot that actually, you know, saw what they believed to be the Falk monster. There are other individuals who are out there looking, and in some cases have claimed 40 sightings and so forth. But I tend to dismiss that because it's just simply not that easy. I mean, now, I guess if you lived in the woods, but, you know, you got guys like Smokey Crabtree, who people will be familiar with if they know Boggy Creek lore. You know, Smokey grew up in the Sulphur River Bottoms, lived there all of his life, and later in life after his son had a sighting in 1965, was actively trying to pursue the creature. He never had a definitive sighting, and this guy is the best woodsman I know. Or he's passed away now, but this guy was, he was the real deal. So anybody in modern times who takes up the mantle of Bigfoot hunter and marches in there, you know, sort of walks off the main road and suddenly sees the Pauk monster every time, I'm very doubtful of. So I just simply don't include things like that, but I don't need to, because there's so many very credible reports that, you know, if there's suspicious type things, I just simply error on the side of not including them, because I definitely don't want to include things that would give the implication that people are making up these things.
Yeah. I think that is, I mean, you do mention that in the book, and I think it's sometimes an easy trap to fall into, Lyle, that you try and get as much evidence rather than the quality of the evidence. And I think that's what stands the Boggy Creek casebook in good stead, is the fact that there is nothing like that. And like you say, you know, there are people that have been out searching for mysterious creatures for their entire lives who have never had a sighting. So I'm automatically suspicious of anybody that, you know, anybody that starts seeing, claiming sightings in double digits. They're either the world's greatest hunter, or they're very lucky, or there is only one other explanation.
Right. Yeah. So, and you know, you're right. It to me, it, and I've always been this way about cryptid research or anything that I do personally, is there's enough, you know, it's a quality over quantity. So, you know, I've seen things down there, and things have occurred, and this in the casebook is the first time I talked about a possible footprint that my late friend Tom Shirley and I found there several years ago. You know, I find something like that, I can't, you know, it's not definitive proof. It's not the best footprint in the world. So I didn't make a big deal out of it. But in terms of writing about the history of that area, of course, I wanted to include that. But I'm always looking for something that's, you know, as far as if it's me toting that there's some evidence, it better be really good for me to, you know, blow the horn and go around saying that I found this. So I'm kind of reserved and error in the, you know, be balanced. And if I do find something really, really good, you can be assured it's going to be out there widely. Mm-hmm. But so far, anything I've seen is just kind of folded into the context of, well, you know, this could support what people are seeing down there.
Yeah. I think there are two other aspects of the creature that I've always found very interesting. And firstly is, and this seems to be, you know, I don't mean this disrespectfully, this seems to be a southern cryptid thing. It's very aggressive, Lyle. It doesn't act like we're often told the West Coast Bigfoot or the Northern Bigfoot sort of behaves, that it seems to be quite shy and it always tries to get out of the way. Whereas wherever this is seems to be very aggressive on occasions and doesn't want to sort of run away and hide. It will basically scare people if it needs to. And obviously there are several encounters where people have got too close to for comfort, really.
Yeah, you know, that's and it's truly one of the things that attracts me to it, is it does have that southern flavor, and it also has that element of danger. You know, and that's really what made the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek a success, was that it scared people. I mean, while it's, you know, plays up obviously the most sensational and scary aspects of it in the movie, that's was based on real reports. And you know, the focus becomes those of where it tries to get in a house or attack people. And then in my book, there's some that have never been publicized where the thing is acting very aggressively and very scary. I mean, it has scared hunters. It scared guys who have guns so much that they flee. And rightly so. If you saw something like that, would be spooky enough, but if it was, you know, showing aggression or potentially coming after you, that would be a scary thing. So you know, those things in some ways, you know, almost get the most attention, you know, that they're aggressive. And certainly not all of those sightings are anything of the such, you know. People still have the sort of, they glimpsed it or it came across the road and it, things like that. But yeah, the Southern Bigfoot has been known to, you know, be aggressive and attack people, perhaps even killed people. I mean, I've heard rumors about things like that, but I never could really find a, you know, the right kind of documentation to back it up. So I never really include those.
Yeah, I mean, it's always best to err on the side of... I mean, that's one of those things you don't really want it to be true, as enticing as those kind of stories could be, Lyle, because I think that takes it to a whole different level, because there are enough encounters here. One of the other aspects is the amount of people that have encounters at night. I'm thinking primarily, I think one of the best ones was one of the most famous cases, which I think is Mary Beth Searcy, who was so scared that her and the rest of the people in her house could not sleep the rest of that night. That seems a very over-the-top reaction to a misidentification. Do you know what I mean? Because clearly they'd seen something that chilled her so much that was it. She just could not sleep.
Yeah, I mean, it was something unfamiliar, and I...
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I can very well understand why it was so frightening, because I've been to that very house where the Searcys lived, and that house was shown in The Legend of Boggy Creek, used in the actual film. But that's where the sighting happened, and Mary Beth you know, was looking out the window. And this house it's an old house. It's, you know, it's not a brick house. It's wood, drafty, small. And the place where they live is down in the Sulphur River area. And at the time, back in the 60s, you know, those houses were very spread out. They're still just basically in the woods. Mm. And it's even more so back then. The roads weren't even paved.
Yeah.
Until the 60s. And so you're way off from any sort of help or, you know, and very far from any explanation as to what you saw lurking out the window. So you would feel very vulnerable, you know, especially a girl or the women. And man, it just must have been a really spooky experience.
Yeah, I think there's one case where I'm glad I'm not this woman's son, because there was one woman who had an encounter, and she sent her son to the landlord. And I thought, there's no way, if there was something like that running around my yard, Lyle, there's no way, I don't care how much I love my mum. You know, I wouldn't be off out into the darkness knowing that there was something creeping about, to be fair.
Well, yeah, that's true. I guess back in those days, kids minded their parents, and they did. Even if your mama said run a few miles into town and tell somebody we saw a hairy wild man, well, that young man did what he was told. But that I know very well, if that would have been me, I'd have been scared every step I ran, and I would have been running fast.
Yeah, it's a shame we didn't time him. I think he might have broken a couple of world records, Lyle, running.
Undoubted.
I mean, it is interesting as well, as we touched on there, Mary Beth. Mary Beth, the other thing about the film is obviously a lot of the people that had had encounters, Lyle, actually appear in the film, because I think Mary Beth ended up playing her sister in the dramatisation of her encounter, did she?
Right. So, yeah, that was the interesting thing, a little trivia. And I include these kind of notes in the casebook as sort of fout facts. And, yeah, so she had her sighting roughly in 1964. So when they filmed the movie in 71, Pierce was trying to be very accurate. So she was a little older at that time. So she actually played the part of her own sister. So Mary Beth is in the scene, but she doesn't play Mary Beth as dramatized in the sighting. It's cool stuff, and it gives, again, some legitimacy and integrity to the legend of Boggy Creek, because you literally had the people, in some cases, who had the encounters reenacting it in the film. It wasn't just all actors or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've often found that quite interesting, because I know my understanding, Lyle, is that originally it was going to be a documentary about it, and then it became like a drama documentary. Have you ever found out what the reason was for the change in tact that Charles Pierce decided to change it from a documentary to that? Or did he just think it would be a better product?
Yeah, I think that they just felt it would be more appealing as a movie. It was originally tentatively titled Tracking the Falk Monster, and so it was definitely more of a documentary approach. But documentaries back then they're not like it is now. I mean, documentaries win awards today, and they're people love that and watch it a lot. Back then, it would have been a little bit of a risk to put it out as a documentary as opposed to making it sort of just more of a movie. And that's what ended up, ironically, making it so effective, because they had kind of come at it with this documentary approach, but then in the end, let's call it The Legend of Boggy Creek. It just sounds way more, mysterious and spooky and appealing. Somebody wants to see that. So it became sort of a mix between documentary and feature film. And I remember when I saw it, it looked so much like a newsreel or something. I mean, and you had real people on camera, and authentic people, and it just made the whole thing way more scary, because this wasn't by any means a Hollywood looking film or anything you've seen before. It just looked like people down there in the backwoods telling their story while it's being reenacted with a spooky looking hairy creature. So that to me, was a genius move, really, by Charles Pierce and Earl Smith, who wrote the script, is just to kind of spin it more as a movie, even though they kept the documentary approach.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've spoken to some of the people that appeared in it, Lyle. I've often been interested to find out, do you think it would have, or did it, sort of reignite how they felt during their encounters? Because, for somebody like Mary Beth to play herself in that kind of situation, it would be quite interesting to see if it brought it all home again.
Oh, I'm sure that, it may not have been the funnest thing to do, because she had already been traumatized by the sighting, and then she had been ridiculed in school, because even though she wasn't the only young person who had had a sighting back in the 60s, it's just the way kids are. Oh, you saw a monster, or whatever. and she just probably suffered a lot of teasing, and so then to have to reenact it, and now your experience is on the big screen, which brings it all back up, and it brings up the questions again, and the people asking, and the people doubtful of you, which is not something that somebody like that sets out to attract. And so she probably ultimately might have regretted ever coming forward and saying she had seen something, because, you know, nobody can imagine that years later people are still asking, and now you're in a movie and mm-hmm. and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I'm sure for some of those witnesses, if they had to rehash what they had seen, if they had been traumatized, it would remind them of that traumatizing experience.
Yeah, I think obviously it would be remiss of me not probably to mention the most notable incident, I think, from that period, Lyle, which is obviously the incident that occurred 1971, April to May, where the Ford family essentially had a 4 or 5 day battle, you could suggest, with an unwanted visitor. Do you think that's the aspect of this whole case that basically cemented its reputation, Lyle?
Yeah, absolutely. The experience that the Ford family reported, which occurred, like you say, in May and April of May of 1971, was the first time that the reports of that sort of creature were made public, and that was by way of the Texarkana Gazette newspaper. And because of the fact that, it had been creeping around the house and they had been trying to shoot at it, and eventually it attacked Bobby Ford and he ended up in the Texarkana hospital, you know, that was just some crazy news, and it attracted a lot of attention and investigation and people trying to figure out what the heck it was. And, you know, was it a hoax? Is there some sort of a strange animal living down here? And so that's always sort of the most notable one. And it's also the most lengthy, because it's not just simply I saw it run across the road. It was this thing kept coming back and trying to get in the house, you know, and we shot at it and things like that. And that was also where it was first mentioned that they found some tracks that sort of looked like three-toed tracks. Hmm. And that kind of established as well that the monster may have three toes. And all that was kind of played up in the Legend of Boggy Creek movie. But in the case book, I was, you know, I'd written about the Ford incident, you know, of course covered it in my original book, The Beast of Boggy Creek. But in the case book, I added a lot of other information, and I was able to just tell it start to end as everything that went on. And I've learned more stuff since. So that I feel is, for those that are interested in this case, this is the best, most detailed, you know, discussion of that whole Ford incident.
Yeah. I find it really remarkable, primarily because it was the bit, as I've mentioned before to you, Lyle, for some unknown reason over here in the UK, the BBC decided to show this film at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening in the late 70s or the early 1980s. And so I sat down thinking, oh yeah, you know, I like my monsters. And by 7:30, I was petrified, primarily because of the segment at the Ford house, which stayed with me until I started discussing these things and reading your books and whatnot. And so it's remarkable that whatever was going on kept going on for more than one night, because some of the other encounters people see in it, you know, there are a couple of encounters where something tried to get in one night, or it was walking about on people's porches for a night. But for some reason, whatever this was, took a real shine to this particular property and these particular people for whatever reason, Lyle, and just kept coming back, and it was night after night. So obviously the incident where it reaches through and tries to get one of them, and then I think, is it Bobby that was in the bathroom when it reappeared on one occasion as well? As a young man, when I saw that absolutely terrified me.
Oh yeah, I mean that scene, you know, people come up to me all the time and talk about the movie, and that's the scene that people remember, you know, usually the one where Bobby's, you know, sitting in the bathroom and the creature comes to the window, or, you know, where he jumps through the front door. Those scenes are the most effective and the most memorable. And, you know, we're just in made people remember that Ford sighting and made people still fascinated with it. They want to know more about it. You know, they had seen it in The Legend of Boggy Creek. They knew it was a real incident or string of incidents and want to know more. So, and then, you know, the theory was that they had a little dog that lived in the house, and, you know, the Fords, you know, conjectured that perhaps this creature was trying to get at their dog. That was their best explanation as to why it kept coming around the house and even reaching in the window and stuff like that, that it was after the dog. But, you know, who knows, for whatever reason, whatever this thing was, you know, did just return more times than it usually would to one specific location.
And there also seems to have been, you know, when you read what happened and the breakdown that you've put in the case book, I think there's one particular evening where the police come and then they go and then it comes back. It's almost as if it's watching Lyle, and that, I think, also gives it a lot of credence, because it seems to be showing a level of intelligence where it can actually understand what's happening and it can help hold back.
Yeah, I mean, and naturally, if there's, you know, cars driving up and people outside talking and things, of course it retreated to the woods, and then every time they would seem to get settled down and get in the house, then suddenly the thing's back. You know, so, you know, that does make sense. I mean, I guess in terms of its reaction, if people were kind of coming and going. And, you know, there's been, I've heard a lot of, you know, people throw out some explanation to me or to say they know what really happened and so forth in this case. And I've heard all kinds of kooky stuff. And, you know, one of the things that was discussed, that people thought it was a horse that was responsible for all this.
Okay.
Stuff like that. Oh, you know, that was just a horse. I'm like, a horse? I mean, there was a stray horse that walked around in that area, and they did actually find the thing shot and dead later on. But a horse doesn't, number one, reach in with a hairy hand. Two, it probably wouldn't get up on the porch, and if it did, you would hear a clip-clopping of the hooves.
Yeah.
And if you ran out the door to confront it with a shotgun, a horse is going to have a much harder time, you know, getting away and running towards the woods without you. I mean, you would immediately say, "Oop, there's a horse." I mean, how, you know, you wouldn't go, it looks like a 7-foot-tall, hairy, upright humanoid thing running towards the woods. I mean, you would easily be able to tell it's a horse. So things like that just always crack me up when people try to tell me the inside. Well, you know, that was a horse. I'm like, oh, okay. And I just kind of like, oh, well, great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the other explanations is that they were all drunk. But I think Bobby actually, when he went to the hospital, they tested his blood, and it proved he'd not had a drink at all. Because once again, you have that kind of, I mean, this is the other thing, Lyle, and I'm sure you can attest to this. You know, I've drunk for quite a number of years. You know, I'm quite partial to a JD. I've never drunk enough that's made me hallucinate that hairy monsters are trying to get in my house.
Right. Yeah, that just is crazy. And I mean, it was multiple individuals. I mean, there's two couples, there's kids.
Yeah.
There's Bobby, the brother. There's Corky Hill, the young visitor. All those people, you can't tell me that all, every bit of them was so drunk, you know, that they hallucinated. So that, again, just doesn't make any sense. You know, these explanations. I heard one people to one another theory was that some people in Falk didn't want them living there, so they decided to get a record player, a phonograph player, and go out there and play scary noises in the woods. And I'm like, you know, I mean, I guess there was probably battery powered record players back at the time. I don't know, but Or, I mean, what are you running an ace, an extension cord out there, or plugging in this thing? And what record are you playing that has, you know, Bigfoot howls or whatever it was? It's just, I'm like, oh, that's a good one. You know, the explanations are often more kooky sounding than just saying, well, you know, it was a Bigfoot, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, often I think that when the explanation becomes more ridiculous than the actual incident, I think you're in trouble, because, I mean, obviously this shook these people up so much that they thought, we've had enough of this, and they just went, which, you know, with the greatest respect, if they're trying to get cheap rent or they're just mucking about, why would you, you know, I think they'd been there about a week, hadn't they?
Yeah, barely a week, and that was enough for them. And these folks weren't, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, hoity-toity city folks moving to the country that just got spooked. I mean, they were, you know, they were from Arkansas. They were folks that weren't apt to be frightened by living in a rural area or anything like that. You know, they were, you know, conceivably people who would know the difference between, you know, varmints coming around the house and something that's, you know, like what they described and being scary and unexplainable. So, you know, it scared them to death. And they also, you know, once the newspapers got a hold of the story and stuff, and, you know, everybody kept coming down there, they just simply had enough. They're like, it's not worth living down here, and they packed up and left.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think they'd only moved to the area because they were trying to find work, weren't they?
Yeah, I believe it was, they came for work, and they came from a town called Ashdown, which is more northern, or not it, it's north of Falk in Arkansas, and you know, I think they got there like on a Tuesday, and I think they left the next Monday, so it really wasn't very long.
Yeah, which I think once again for me gives the whole thing credence, because you just, but why would you put that much effort into doing something when you're not from the area, you're trying to get a job, and then you're that scared by what's happened, you're gone within less than a week. It just baffles me that anybody could suggest that they set the whole thing up for no reason at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's there is a 0% chance that they concocted this, or they themselves made it up or hoaxed it. That's definitely you know, not an explanation. So what I always say, something happened there. Something was coming up there, something on the porch, something that they could not identify or explain, and something that they were shooting at, and it still kept coming up. And that's a problem I have as well. You know, if people trying to run them off or whatever they were doing, I was like, these whomever would have been doing that would have been nuts, because they were literally shooting, you know. It's like, why would you come back up to the porch? You'd be in jeopardy of being shot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the same thing with that incident. Always reminds me of the Hopkinsville Goblins incident, Lyle, because they were shooting at that, and people say, oh yeah, they were either all drunk or they'd just seen owls. And I've said, well, I've yet to find an owl that's bulletproof, Lyle. You know, it just doesn't make sense that it can be written off as just somebody mucking about or trying to scare them off. Because, like you say, these people, because I think they said they'd shot it as well and went to check where they, because they, I think they thought they dropped it at one point, did they?
Yeah, they were pretty sure they had hit it.
Yeah, so it's just one of those things. And I think speedily, we'll bring it up to date, because as we started at the beginning, I think it's one of those things that a lot of people, until recent, you know, until your investigations and your excellent books on the subject, Lyle, have made people realise that this is still continuing. And I know in the case book you've got two or three sightings taken from last year. So what struck me about a couple of those is that both of the witnesses saw the creature in binoculars. Which once again kind of takes away any potential, because yeah, fair enough, if you see something 150, 200 yards away in dusk or bad light, Lyle, yeah, fair enough, you might be misidentifying something, or it might not just be what you think. But when you've got a pair of binoculars trained on it, you can clearly work out what you're looking at. And I think those two encounters, the most recent ones that are included in the book, both of those people clearly saw something unusual through binoculars.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, in one of those cases, I know the individual who had that sighting, and he's a credible person. And in the other one, you know, if it's true, then yeah, there's no mistake of what he saw, because he was observing it for several minutes and looking with high-powered binoculars. A person who is hunting, so he is observant of wild animals. You know, it just defies explanation, and just goes to show that there's just still reports coming out of the Boggy Creek area.
Mm. I mean, have you had anything land on your desk from this year so far, Lyle, or has things quietened down in the current climate, or is it something that still continues to be occasionally witnessed?
This year's been a bit quiet. I haven't gotten any major reports this year. I don't know if could, you know, some years it goes like that. But yeah, there's been nothing so far this year. So, you know, pretty much most of this goes up through December of 2019, which is about where I cut off with the, you know, with the book manuscript.
Yeah. But I mean, they are very compelling sightings. And once again, the thing that strikes me is that these people don't seem to be exaggerating it. They're very simple in their explanations, Lyle. It's very matter of fact.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they don't, you know, which I like. It's just, it's kind of like the modern sightings are just like the classics, you know, which is simply this strange ape-like creature that's seen in the woods down there, you know, and nobody imparts any supernatural powers to it. It's not doing anything that is any different than it's always been doing, which is creeping around in those bottoms and occasionally being seen, and presumably a flesh and blood type creature that you know, could very well have a population that, you know, survives back in those bottoms, because it's heavily forested, remote, thick brush, rugged, and a place that's in many parts still very much undeveloped.
Yeah. And obviously the town clearly has embraced it now, because it's one of those things, and I know we've mentioned this when we've spoken before about certain places, Lyle, that folk seems to be very proud of having this monster, because it seems a festival even over what's happened in the country in the last 12 months. It still went ahead with its festival in the summer, and I believe you were a speaker as one would expect this year. And obviously, I think, did it have to be moved to Texarkana this year, because obviously for COVID? So is it something that continues to grow, as you've noticed this over the last few years, Lyle?
Yeah, I think I've seen a growth in the interest in it, and having the festivals and things certainly helps. You know, gives people a reason to come down there and visit. But you know, on a weekly basis, people come there and drop by the Monster Mart. And you know, it just continues to have life, and something new is always coming out. You know, whether it's my book or the remastered version of the film or the documentary we did a few years ago, the Boggy Creek Monster documentary with Small Town Monsters. So, you know, even this year, yeah, that the festival had to be adjusted to have a larger, more socially distant type venue, so it couldn't. Falk doesn't have very big facilities, but you know, and certainly it wasn't like it would be in normal years, but still, you know, people showed up and did our best under the circumstances with masks and social distancing and so forth. But as I always say, the legend lives on, and it continues to draw the fascination from people who saw the movie back in the day, all the way to young people who have seen the movie or have gotten into Bigfoot and want to, you know, look into what is probably the most classic of Southern Bigfoot cases.
And it is, and the other thing that I found quite endearing about the festival is it's all for charity as well, isn't it? Because I know they raise money for the local school board, I believe.
Yes, that's something that was important to do by the producer Craig Woolheater. Is to do something for the town, because that's the whole point here is it's great to have the legend, and it certainly generates interest in people coming to the town. But if it can give back, you know, if it can provide resources for the kids there in their education and things, then it gives people more of a reason to be proud of it. And people in the town, not all of them, are necessarily proud of it or even believe in it. But I don't think you can deny the fact that, hey, you've got this legend associated with your area. It's sort of a touristy roadside attraction. Why not make the best of it? You know, that's the thing. It's there whether you like it or not. And so, you know, people have come forward, and I feel good about being involved in something that can give back to the town, because, you know, I have an affection for the people there and the town, and we have a lot of friends, and I really enjoy being able to give back. And if that's through the festival and speaking at a festival or whatever it is I do to benefit the locals, then yeah, that's it's all kind of full circle, and the best thing about small town monsters, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely, because it is, you know, as you say, it's one of those things that I think with the documentary that Seth and the guys did, with yourself narrating it and being involved in that, Lyle, and obviously Pamela's got the rights to her father's film and had it beautifully restored, and I know you did some work on that, doing some extras and things like that. So it just seems it's finally being able, you know, the beast is finally bringing something to a town that, with the greatest respect, most people would never have even heard of without this creature. So it's certainly put it on the map and allowing it to grow, I would imagine, in a way it possibly never expected.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I never would have expected, you know, a decade on into the research I've done there, that it would have so much life to it and continued interest. So, I mean, in some ways I picked the right topic, but it was just a topic that I was fascinated with myself, and nobody had really brought it into the modern era. So I felt that was my role. So it's, you know, it's just great to see that people are interested in all this stuff, and even the case book. You know, I mean, I had more pre-orders on this book than I've had any other book yet. So it just shows that it's continued to be popular.
Yeah. Well, and we are thankful that it was the case that struck a chord with you, Lyle, because it's, you know, it's an excellent body of work, and long may it continue. So as we touched on as well in my introduction, you've just released a new album for Ghoul Town. So what's it like getting the band back together in very challenging circumstances, I can imagine?
Yeah, it worked out good. I mean, every once in a while we do an album. I mean, the band has a good worldwide following, and while, you know, I kind of split between books and music because I enjoy both, and you know, because we weren't really touring or doing a lot of gigs this year, we were just going to record. So, you know, the whole shutdown and basically the canceling almost universally of the touring market didn't really have any effect. We just sort of worked behind the scenes, got the album done. And then I've just been working with that to to meet the demand on the release as well at the same time of the book. So yeah, it's just it's great though. I mean, all things have been well received, from the music to the writing, and that's certainly what you want when you're a author and musician. So it's been a great year.
Absolutely. Well, before I let you go, what's next on your agenda then, Lyle? Is there anything in the pipeline, or have you got anything you want to delve into, or is Boggy Creek the thing that will always keep pulling you back?
Well, I think Boggy Creek will always, you know, pull me back at times. It's always sort of the constant. Going forward, I've got some plans to do something a little bit different. So next year's gonna hold some surprises, in which I'm going to do something a little bit different. But in the meantime, I'm going to take time off from the busy schedule of working around the clock. So I don't know, 2021 might be a slower year for me. Probably not, but somehow I try to plan on that.
Well, fantastic. Whatever you've got in store, I'm looking forward to it, based on your body of work, and long may it continue, Lyle. So where can everybody get hold of the book and track down your latest album for Ghoultown?
You can find my books on Amazon, and you can also get them through my online store. So if you visit LyleBlackburn.com, there's links there to my store and links to all the Amazon pages where my books are found. You can find Ghoultown Music at ghoultown.com, ghoultown.com, and it's also available wherever finer music is sold, iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, Bandcamp, anywhere. So it's easy to find. So just drop by LyleBlackburn.com and it will point you in the right directions.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you as always, Lyle. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I always look forward to seeing what you've got released. We've been spoiled this year with two books, and both of them are excellent. So as always, my friend, thank you for joining me, and to you and yours, you have a good Christmas.
Thank you very much. I always enjoy the show.
This creature, whatever it is, emits one of the most terrifying sounds ever recorded.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.